So if you have a Bible, would you turn back to that passage, please, in Mark's Gospel and chapter 10, page 1015, if you have one of the church Bibles. I think my favourite Christmas media story this year comes from that hotbed of amusing stories, Oldham in Lancashire. More specifically from Blackshaw Lane Primary School, where a female supply teacher made the hideous mistake of telling a class of 7-year-olds that Father Christmas didn't really exist. Kiddies, it is really your parents who put out the presents on Christmas Day. And several of the aforesaid parents were so scandalised by this revelation that they made complaints to the head teacher, Angela McCormick by name, who in turn extracted an apology from the supply teacher and made it clear she would never be welcome in her school again. Mrs. McCormick then made her own apology to the distressed parents and to the traumatised Year 3 class involved. The school governor's reaction also caught my eye. One of them, Steve Bashforth, was quoted as saying, "It takes more than one Grinch to spoil the magic of Christmas." As an ex-primary school governor myself, I wondered if I would respond in the same way. And to cap it all, the local council have responded by launching an investigation into the whole sorry affair. It seems that Father Christmas must be held in very high esteem in Lancashire. Now, I don't know what you make of this story. I'm certainly not here to pass judgment on what you tell the kids in your family about Santa Claus. It's an area where strong views are held, after all. If you want my personal advice, I will have to arrange a private consultation at a time of your convenience. But what sums it up for me is the words of that school governor about the magic of Christmas. Apparently, the magic of Christmas consists in large part of maintaining a fantasy about a large, jolly man with a red suit and a long white beard. And woe betide anyone who tries to move on from there. Actually, that's why there was such a national outcry about that other great Christmas story from a couple of weeks back, about the Lapland Winter Wonderland theme park down in the New Forest. Did you see that one? It promised a magical world of snow and log cabins and a bustling market and a vivid nativity scene. And people in their hundreds bought up tickets at £25 a throw. And when they turned up, the place consisted mainly of painted sheds in a field and a few discouraged-looking husky dogs. But the worst scandal of all was that Santa was spotted having a fag break at the back of his grotto. As a result, in the words of Adrian Wood, now ex-security guard at Lapland New Forest, Santa got attacked, one of the elves got smacked in the face and pushed into a pram. What would the governors of Blackshaw Lane Primary School have to say about that? The point is that people prefer their fantasies to the reality. They prefer their kids to have the fantasy rather than the reality. Well, you might say, in current circumstances, who can blame them? And yet, in the case of Christmas, the reality is a million times better than the fantasy. Father Christmas, even if he's real, might dish out a few presents, but he can't fix your life. But we know a man who can. We know that the real magic of Christmas is far more exciting than anything that goes on in Santa's grotto. The real magic of Christmas, of course, is about Jesus, the baby of Bethlehem, and what happened to him in the 33 years which followed. Seeing the real Christmas is about seeing the real Jesus. And that's what we're here for this morning. We've been working gradually through Mark's Gospel, mainly on Sunday evenings. And what Mark does, bit by bit in his Gospel, is to reveal to us Jesus. First, his basic identity, that he is the Messiah, the Christ, and then to show us what that will really mean. Who is the real Jesus? And I say we've been studying Mark in the evenings, so let me remind you that if you've missed some of those messages, they're all available online on the church website. There are tapes available as well, but let me also encourage you to be here in the evenings, as well as the mornings, if you possibly can, so that you don't miss out. Now, Mark, like the other gospel writers, does not just throw stories together at random. He has not picked out these episodes in his book just because they're the nicest stories, or the most dramatic stories, or even the most memorable stories. He has selected these episodes because of what they show us about the Lord Jesus Christ. Jesus' 3 years of public ministry would have produced hundreds of stories like this one, teaching, parables, and miracles by the score, and most of them we never hear about. But we hear about this one because Mark has chosen it to reveal more about Jesus as he heads up to Jerusalem towards the end of his life. Although Jesus must have healed hundreds of blind people during his ministry, Mark picks out exactly two of them. This is the second. And remarkably, both of these stories he uses in this same way. Outside these two stories, Mark never even mentions blindness at all. But giving sight to blind eyes symbolizes the way God opens our eyes to see the real Jesus for ourselves. So let's have a look at this story, a familiar one to many of us, probably one we heard at Sunday school. But actually, as we stand here on the verge of Christmas, a story with a great deal to tell us about seeing the real Jesus. And the scene Mark paints for us is of a noisy, bustling throng leaving the ancient city of Jericho. Jesus himself, the 12 disciples, and a large crowd. Jesus has been on this journey for some time now. We've been following his progress. At this point, he's recrossed the River Jordan. Jericho is 5 miles beyond the river and just 18 miles, one day's walk, short of the city of Jerusalem. And most of this crowd will be pilgrims on their way up to the great city. The Passover festival is now only a couple of weeks away. And thousands of people are converging on the capital, Jews from all over Israel and beyond. This cavalcade in Jericho is just one component of that great movement of people. But some of the crowd, undoubtedly, are also keeping a very close eye on Jesus. He's done so many amazing deeds, spoken so many startling words, and the rumours about him have flown far and wide. They know he's heading up to Jerusalem. They've realised there's something special about him. And now they will make sure they're travelling along with him just to see what he's going to do next. It's not an unusual sight to come across a beggar at the side of the road, a busy road, this, even if it's known to be dangerous, carries a lot of traffic. This man is blind and therefore unable to support himself through work. Mark tells us, which the other Gospels don't, that his name is Bartimaeus, or the son of Timai. Actually, it's unusual for Mark to name people in the miracle stories, and this name check may mean that Bartimaeus later is someone well known to the church, but who knows? In any case, he will not remain an anonymous beggar. It's very obvious to Bartimaeus that a crowd is approaching. There's a noise down the street, the pounding of feet on the ground and the smell of dust in the air. And as soon as he discovers the identity of the man in the middle of it all, Bartimaeus starts to shout. Clearly he's heard of this Jesus of Nazareth. The stories about him are being swapped up and down every road in the land. And a blind man learns to be very skilled at tuning in to the latest news. From what he has heard, Bartimaeus has put two and two together. Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me, he calls. How much does he know about Jesus? We can't be sure. But he knows this is someone special, someone who can give him a chance. Someone he has to meet. Normally he calls out for money. It's the only way he can survive. But not this time. Mercy is what you ask from someone who's greater than you. Bartimaeus understands this at least. Jesus can give him something better than money. Jesus can give him his sight back. The crowd around Jesus tell him in no uncertain terms to shut up. It wouldn't be surprising, in fact, if this is Jesus' own disciples again, reprising their performance in verse 13, when they tried to shield Jesus from the attentions of the families and children who were trying to get to him. Jesus has other matters on his mind. He has a schedule to keep, and he certainly doesn't want to be bothered with you. But Bartimaeus is still shouting. He refuses to be put off. Son of David, have mercy on me. And it soon turns out that Jesus does want to be bothered with you. He very much wants to be bothered with you. Because he stops. No doubt everyone else stops too. Whatever is Jesus going to do now? Call him, he says. And suddenly at this point the crowd switches sides. Now Bartimaeus becomes the focus of everyone's attention as they call him. Come on, over here. The man's been seated by the roadside, ready to receive whatever people drop in his begging bowl. But the moment he hears this call, he springs into action. Not a moment is wasted. He throws his coat on the ground, he leaps up to his feet, and guided by the sounds, he makes his way over to where Jesus stands, waiting for him to come. Jesus asks him, "What do you want me to do for you?" Which, interestingly, is exactly the same question he asked James and John in last week's story, back in verse 36. What they wanted was glory, honour, prestige, pride of place alongside Jesus in the kingdom of God. Aha, here's a clue as to why Mark has included this story. Still blind to the true nature of Jesus' mission, James and John made a grab for glory. They should have realised what Jesus has come for, but they didn't. Now here stands a man who is literally blind. What do you want me to do? The answer will be pretty obvious. But Jesus wants him to speak it out, because speaking it out makes his need clearer and encourages his faith. I want to see. And in fact, he calls Jesus Rabboni, the more respectful form of the word rabbi. My Lord, my Master. Jesus doesn't need any dramatic gestures. In a moment, without any fuss, Bartimaeus receives what he asks for. Suddenly his darkness is ended. The lights are switched on. The sun shines again. Bartimaeus can see. And with that he turns, he falls in behind Jesus, and he sets off with the crowd. He too is now heading for Jerusalem, part of the crowd heading up to the temple. But Bartimaeus will have a special additional reason for going there. He will be making a sacrifice to thank God for giving back his sight. No longer a helpless beggar, Bartimaeus now has a life. So how does this story show us the real Jesus? I simply want to pick up three aspects of Jesus that Mark gives us here, showing us the real Jesus we all need to see. The first one, Jesus the living man. Jesus the living man. Look at verse 47. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout. Jesus of Nazareth, an ordinary name. In that culture, a man is known generally by a single name of his own, plus the name of his father, or the place where he comes from. It's the same in many parts of the world today. That's how names are constructed. That would identify you. And that's the name that Jesus is known by up and down the land. The name that Bartimaeus hears. A perfectly ordinary human name. Jesus is the living man who spent 3 years walking the dusty pathways and treading the steep hillsides of Galilee and Judea. A normal looking man, a real, live, ordinary human, the one the crowds see. A man like us, who's come to be one of us. If he'd grown up in Bethlehem, he would have been known as Jesus of Bethlehem. But he didn't. He grew up in Nazareth, a man with a real family, with an ordinary job, with friends and neighbours in the village. Jesus of Nazareth, the man, the human being. And this is the way that most people see Jesus today. This is the way that most people will think of him this Christmas, if they think of him at all. As a baby in a manger in Bethlehem, and they will see no more than that. But Mark wants to show us that there is more to Jesus than that. And so to the second aspect of Jesus. Jesus the coming King. Jesus the coming King. What does Bartimaeus shout? Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And again, even when they try to shut him up, Son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus hears this call and listens and stops walking. But what does Son of David actually mean? Well, these Jews certainly have long memories. David is King David, who reigned over Israel 1,000 years ago, their greatest of all kings. And the great longing of the Jewish people at this time is that God will intervene in their nation's sad story again, place a descendant of David on the royal throne once more, and bring in a golden age. The prophets have promised it, and the people yearn for it. Especially now, after 100 years of Roman occupation have snuffed out the last living memory of national independence. And using the expression, Son of David, evokes that picture of the promised coming King. But does Bartimaeus know that Jesus of Nazareth is literally a descendant of David? It's quite possible that he doesn't. It may simply be a respectful title that indicates someone worthy to be mentioned in the same breath as the great David, and someone God is using to bring healing and blessing to the land. The fact that Jerusalem is just up the road, Jerusalem, the city David himself established as his capital and where he reigns supreme, that fact is always there in the background too. But even if Bartimaeus doesn't have the full picture and doesn't really understand what he is saying, Mark certainly does. And Bartimaeus may well have guessed it. Jesus is indeed David's literal descendant. And Jesus is indeed the coming King, promised by God through the prophets. Here's what Jeremiah said 600 years before, from Jeremiah 23, verses 5 and 6. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up to David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will live in safety. This is the name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. That's the dream. That's the longing. And in Jesus, the dream is going to become reality. The King is coming. The true Son of David. Mark began his story with Jesus' identity a secret. And little by little, through his gospel, the curtain's been lifted and more has been revealed. And now, here, just a day out from Jerusalem, the time for secrecy is past. Jesus has accepted the title which a blind man has given him, Son of David. And very soon now, as the crowds acclaim his entry into Jerusalem itself, this is what they will be crying. Chapter 11, verse 10. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. And Jesus' true identity must be made known, so that when he dies in Jerusalem, it will be clear that he dies as the Messiah. He dies as the coming King. That death will be a horrifying shock to his friends and his followers. Yet it will be the very climax of his mission, because he has come for this, to die for our sins, to take our place in paying the penalty. And this death, this cross, will begin his enthronement as King. Jesus, the living man, Jesus, the coming king. And number three, Jesus, the splendor of God's. Jesus, the splendor of God's. Here's what Bartimaeus certainly doesn't know, not yet at least, but Mark does, and he's put the clues in the story. Let's read verses 49 to 52 again. Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called to the blind man, "Cheer up." Actually, more literally, "Take courage. On your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," said Jesus, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the roads. Now look at Isaiah 35. It's worth turning to if you have a Bible, page 719 in the Bibles in the chairs. Some of it's on the screen, but not all of it. Isaiah 35. Again, from hundreds of years before Jesus came. This is from the prophecy of Isaiah, speaking in poetic words, metaphorical words, about what it will be like when God intervenes to save his people. Isaiah 35, verse 1. "The desert and the parched land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it will burst into bloom. It will rejoice greatly and shout for joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the splendor of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God. Strengthen the feeble hands, steady the knees that give way. Say to those with fearful hearts, 'Be strong, do not fear. Your God will come. He will come with vengeance, with divine retribution. He will come to save you. Then will the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer and the mute tongue shout for joy.'" Verse 8, "And a highway will be there. It will be called the way of holiness. The unclean will not journey on it. It will be for those who walk in that way. Wicked fools will not go about on it. No lion will be there, nor will any ferocious beast get up on it. They will not be found there, but only the redeemed will walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away." What will begin to happen when God at last breaks in? We read about the land being glad, breaking into new life as God reveals his glory and splendor. We read about specific signs that will be seen as God begins to move. We read in verse 10 about a highway of pilgrimage, God's people streaming up to Zion, up to Jerusalem, singing his praises and being crowned with everlasting joy. And the signs that Isaiah mentions that will be seen in the land are these, verses 3 to 6. "The feeble and weak will be made strong so that they can stand strongly on their feet. A message of courage to those who fear, because God is coming. The eyes of the blind will be opened. The deaf will hear. The lame will leap. And the mutes will shout for joy." Now, Mark's already pointed us to this passage at least once before. And if you can remember back, you might remember the story at the end of Mark chapter 7 about the man who was deaf and tongue-tied, and Jesus wonderfully heals him. And we saw there how, through the use of a very unusual word, Mark points back from that story to Isaiah 35, 5 and 6. But now we're seeing it again. How does Mark describe the response of Bartimaeus? They say to him, "Take courage and get on your feet." On the face of it, not the most obvious words that you'd say to a blind man. But Mark is pointing us back to Isaiah 35. And then, of course, it happens. The eyes of the blind are opened. And in events like these, Isaiah says, they will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God. The appearance of Jesus is the splendor of God revealed. Not fully, not yet, not completely as yet. We are not yet at the place of everlasting joy. Sorrow and sighing have not yet fled away. Isaiah 35 has not been completely fulfilled. But for those who are on the pilgrimage highway up to Zion, up to Jerusalem, oh, it should be coming plain to see that in Jesus the glory and splendor of God are shining out on the earth. Little by little it becomes evident that this is nothing less than the coming of God himself. Jesus is more than an emissary. He is more than Messiah. He is more than an earthly king. He is God incarnate, the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. And Jesus coming to earth is the greatest miracle in the long story of the universe. It is a greater miracle than the creation of the galaxies, that God could become man and be born as one of us. The greatest miracle, the splendor of God born for us. So as we close, look once more at Bartimaeus, the blind man who saw Jesus and put his faith in him. Even while he's still blind, he saw far more than the religious authorities could see. The men who should have been leading their nation to bow at Jesus' feet, and instead, within a fortnight of this story, will have him killed. Bartimaeus sees more than that. And he ends the story healed and glad. The word for healed in this story, in fact, also means saved. Your faith has saved you, says Jesus. Indeed it has. When he knows Jesus is here, he persists until he has Jesus' full attention. When he gets the call, he jumps to his feet in an instant. He knows Jesus has the answer he needs. And here's the question for us. Jesus is here. This Christmas, are you and I meeting Jesus with the same delight as Bartimaeus? Do you recognize him as the coming king who will rule and reign in your life? And as the splendor of your God, the light that has shone in the darkness as God himself appears on earth, have your eyes been opened? And will he say to you, your faith has healed you, your faith has saved you? Wherever you've come from, whatever your life has been like, there is new life for you today, if you will have it.